Thank you all for coming. Tonight is the first in a series of six called The Introduction to the Kuzari. Many of you know that I've spent a big chunk of my life trying to understand this particular sefer because it is very expansive in its nature. It's expansive in the sense that it permeates so much of Jewish thought and Torah study and the way that we think as Jews today. And it's sort of my journey in the study of the Kuzari took me to places that I had never been before, and certainly enriched the way that I think as a Jew and I live my life as a Jew. And I wanted to therefore share some of these ideas with you. But before we do that, before we begin to study the Sefer Kuzari, I wanted to offer you an introduction to create the proper fertile soil to be able to grow and to germinate the ideas that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi puts forth in his Sefer, which is a great way of reminding everyone to please turn off your cell phones. Thank you. And the first part of our discussion tonight is going to be discussing the history of the Jews of Al-Andalus, the Jews of Spain, in a period known as the Golden Age of Spanish Jewry. It was known as Al-Andalus or Andalusia by the people who were living there during this particular period that we're discussing. And in order for us to get the proper historical context, and a lot of Jewish history is somewhat fuzzy, we don't know all of the details and all of the ways that things happened and evolved, but we're going to be giving a rough sketch of how the Jewish people sort of got to where they were at this point in Jewish history. We're really beginning at the end of the 9th century, beginning of the 10th century. This is well beyond the period of Chasimah Sashas, of when the Talmud has been completed. Primary Jewish communities are located in Bavel and in Eretz Yisrael during this period of time. And something unusual happens to the Jewish people, that whereas there had always been a presence, a Jewish presence, in the Western world of Europe, going all the way back to the times of the Gemara and possibly even earlier, to the times of the Second Temple, where it was necessary to have a Jewish presence near to Rome in order to be able to placate the Roman government, which was in control of the area of Palestine during the Second Temple era. Nevertheless, this was considered to be a relatively small population of Jews that were living in Europe. And by and large, the European continent was mostly Christian, was run by what was known as the Holy Roman Empire. And the Jews really didn't have very much contact with that part of the Christian world. The Jews were living by and large, as I mentioned, in the Middle East, in two major communities, one in Bavel, which was run by the great Gaonic centers in Sura and Pumbedisa, and the other one was in Eretz Yisrael, which had its own kind of communal system. And there was always, we read about that during this period, there was a continuous rivalry between the two communities, the communities in Eretz Yisrael and the communities in Bavel. And eventually, the Babylonian community prevailed in its customs and in its halachic positions over the community in Eretz Yisrael, which, according to some historians, is the reason why we study the Babylonian Talmud today over the Palestinian Talmud, over the Talmud Yerushalmi. But in any event, this is where we're going to, this is the snapshot that we're taking. End of the 9th century, beginning of the 10th century, and something unusual happens. There's a mass migration of Jews from the Middle East, both from Eretz Yisrael and Bavel, to Europe. First, most Jews enter through either Italy or Spain, and then eventually Jews migrate further and further north into the Rhineland, which is, you know, France and Germany, and then eventually to England. This all happens within a century or two centuries' time, and it's very difficult to exactly explain all of the circumstances that brought about this mass migration. Some have suggested that it was because of mercantile opportunities. A Jew goes where there's parnassa, and so a lot of Jews discover that in the New World there was there were many new financial opportunities. But a lot of it also had to do with the changing tides of the parent culture that was taking place in the Middle East. The Middle East was primarily dominated at that time by the Islamic world, and the Islamic world was able to run its system of government known as a caliphate. And ever since the early 7th century, when Islam officially began as a religion, it took off like wildfire, from originating in the Saudi Arabian Peninsula and then spreading very, very rapidly throughout the Middle East in the Fertile Crescent, and then going westward into Africa, and then eventually beginning to migrate a little bit into Europe, which is what we're going to discuss shortly. This system of government known as the Caliphate could sometimes be very oppressive, but also at other times could be extremely tolerant. And we find that up until about the middle of the 8th century, there was the seat of the Caliphate was located, of the Islamic main point of government, was located in Syria. And it was under the rule of a certain kind of Muslim called the Umayyads, who had a certain kind of religious openness where they felt that while it was important to study the Quran and be able to emphasize the principles of the Islamic faith to the entire world, nevertheless, they understood that when it comes to world domination, you have to be able to not only indoctrinate the nations and the lands that you conquer into the faith of Islam, but you also have to have a certain level of religious tolerance. And so therefore, the Umayyads practiced a certain kind of religious tolerance that allowed the Jewish communities in the Middle East to continue to prosper and to flourish. That doesn't mean that there weren't issues that came up from time to time. Jews and Christians that were living in the Middle East were still consigned to second-class status, but they were allowed to function and they were allowed to live their lives within their Jewish communities according to their religious beliefs. Something happens in the year 750, and that is that the Umayyads are assassinated, the entire Umayyad royal family is assassinated, and there is a dramatic shift in the Islamic world, and there's a group of other Muslims known as the Abbasids who take over the caliphate. And not only do they change the leadership, but they also move the seat of leadership from Syria to Baghdad, which is in Babel. It's the major new metropolitan area in Babel, in Babylonia. And they start to institute some new rules and set down some new policies, especially when as it affects the Jewish community. This is also taking place at around the time when the Gaonic centers of Torah study are beginning to wane, perhaps for some reasons, perhaps may have had to do with internal politics within the Jewish community. And so a number of things are happening that create a tremendous amount of unrest within the Jewish community towards the end of the 8th century and the beginning and throughout the 9th century, which causes a number of Jews to say, you know what, it's time for us to pick up and to move. And so we therefore find that by the 10th century, beginning of the 10th century, you have a presence of Jews that is much larger, that has been migrating both west into Africa and also starting to move into Europe. Now, what happens at the beginning of the 10th century is that Spain, especially, and certain parts of Italy, the southern parts of Europe, are very vulnerable to acculturation. What I mean by that is that the Roman Empire was beginning to decline very dramatically, and as a result, people's cultures, which were partially a combination of ancient pagan beliefs, together melded together with the Christian beliefs of the Roman Empire, was extremely vulnerable. People were not that educated, and the time was ripe for a new culture to come in and take the world by storm. There was a one surviving member of the Umayyad family who had fled Syria at the time of the assassination. His name was Abd al-Rahman, and he decided that he was going to perpetuate the Umayyad family dynasty away from the Abbasid Caliphate. This was a revolutionary concept, because up until that time, there was only one seat of power for the entire Islamic world. And what happened was, as a result of this inner turmoil in the Islamic world, there began this new caliphate that was sort of a breakaway from the main seat of power in the Middle East. And this became known as the Cordoba Caliphate. It was a continuation, ostensibly, of the Umayyad Caliphate in Syria. And it perpetuated the same ideals and religious tolerance that had begun in Syria several years before. So you can imagine, as the Jews are migrating to Europe, they find an extremely hospitable society in the southern part of Spain and in certain parts of Italy. And that's why I presented to you a map of Al-Andalus, which is the Islamic name, or the Arabic name, for this area of Spain that was under Islamic domination at this time. There was, for a period of time, a concern that Muslims would actually overtake the entire European continent, because they were extremely popular and they were extremely powerful. But eventually, because of different political circumstances that took place within the Cordoban Caliphate itself and other circumstances which took place within the Christian world, that never actually came to fruition. But because of this migration of both the Jewish community and the Umayyad Caliphate to southern Europe, you had what was known for about 150 years, known by historians, known as the Golden Age of Spanish Jewry, where there was a time when the Jewish community found a home in southern Europe where they felt that it was a time that was extremely hospitable to them, where they were able to have a tremendous amount of religious tolerance, where they were able to practice the religion freely, and they were able to grow in a way intellectually and culturally in a way that had been, to them, in certain people's minds, had been unprecedented in Jewish history. And that's something that I want to discuss as we try to discover the world into which Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is born. There are several catalysts that are taking place in this Cordoban world, Cordoba being the capital of the caliphate in Spain. You can see where it is located on your map. It's southwestern Spain over there. And it was really the seat of power of the Al-Rahman family. For one thing, there was a tremendous amount of emphasis on literacy and scholarship within the Islamic world. That had started already with the Abbasids. Even though the Abbasids were pretty cruel and they were pretty rough people, they nevertheless found it necessary and important to emphasize literacy and the study of different kinds of literature. And this is actually something that requires a lot more analysis as to what was it about the Islamic world that made them embrace the study of philosophy so much. I mentioned to the women yesterday in the shir that some people theorize that because Islam was the new kid on the block, it was really starting over a half millennium after Christianity had begun, and it was a relatively new faith during this time in history. And Muslims didn't have any historical connection between their founder and the characters of either the Old or the New Testament. Muhammad professed to embrace the teachings of the Old and New Testament, but said that he had come to correct the mistakes of both the Jewish and the Christian Bible. And as a result, he had to study with the angel Gabriel in a cave for many weeks or months, and eventually came out with his version, according to him, the correct version of all of the accounts of the Bible, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, and he presented it to the Arabs of his time. in order to gain a sense of legitimacy among the nations of the world and to sort of assert their authenticity, it may the Muslim world may have felt overall there may have been this this mindset that we need to be able to present ourselves as a sophisticated people, even though we come from a backwater part of the world, the Arabian Peninsula, where we were a bunch of nomadic Bedouin tribes. Can we ask the person who's got that? Okay. So even though they come from a bunch of nomadic tribes in the backwaters of the Arabian Peninsula, Saudi Arabian Peninsula, nevertheless, we have a certain level of sophistication and gravitas, and in order to be able to demonstrate that, we're going to adopt for ourselves the most sophisticated areas of knowledge that are known to modern man. And that was, of course, philosophy as it had been passed down to the both the Christian world and to the general Roman Empire through the great Greek thinkers like Plato and Aristotle and Plotinus and many, many others. So the Islamic world feels a great need to indoctrinate into their culture Greek philosophy and somehow make it fit within Islamic teachings and Islamic doctrine. And you therefore find two different kinds of philosophical endeavors within the Islamic world, beginning in the Middle East and then migrating with Abd al-Rahman into the Cordoba Caliphate afterwards. One was the pure study of philosophy, and there were a huge amount of texts that were translated both from Greek and Latin to Arabic of the writings of Aristotle and many, many other philosophers. And these writings were promulgated throughout the Islamic Empire. And as well, another kind of endeavor that was philosophically oriented known as the Kalam. The Kalam is a certain kind of apologetics. It's a type of argumentation how you can reconcile the Islamic faith with Greek philosophy. And this was a very, very important endeavor to the great theologians within the Islamic world. It became something that was eventually adopted, and the reason why I mention this is it eventually became adopted by great Jewish thinkers as well. Most prominent among them was Rebbe Sadia Gaon, who lives in the 9th century, and is one of the great Jewish leaders of the Babylonian community. And he writes a book called Emunos Videos, the book of faith, writes the book of faith and understanding, or faith and knowledge. And he utilizes the same methodology as the Kalamists that he lives among, to be able to demonstrate that Judaism is a correct faith and the theological foundations of Judaism are extremely sound and consistent with many of the teachings of Greek philosophy. So you find, therefore, that there's this intersection between the Islamic Kalamist kind of philosophical speculation and what's beginning in the Gaonic period in the Middle East, and this eventually migrates to Europe as well. Now, the Muslims were not the only ones to engage in philosophical pursuits. Christianity had actually begun its indoctrination of Greek philosophy even before the founding of the Islamic faith. It began already in the 4th century, which is quite an early period in the Christian church, with St. Augustine and other very, very prominent Christian doctrinaires like Boethius, and later on many, many others who would follow in their footsteps. And there was almost a continuous chain of philosophical speculation within the Christian church. For some reason, however, the Jewish world never intersected with the philosophical discussions that were taking place in the Christian world. I shouldn't say never, and that would be an exaggeration, but there was very, very little intersection between the two. And there are a couple of reasons for this. Number one is that when you consider where the Jewish community was situated in its earlier periods, which was in the Middle East, this was not the area, this was an area that was Islamic primarily, and therefore the original exposure that Jews had to this Greek philosophy reconciled with faith takes place in an Islamic setting. but also consider that even after the Jews have migrated to Europe, and there is a theory that says that most of the Babylonian community settled in the southern part of Europe, in Spain, Sfarad, so therefore the Sephardic tradition is a continuation of the Babylonian tradition, and the Palestinian Jews, the Jews from Eretz Yisrael, migrate and move through Italy, going further north, going into the Rhineland. There seems to be no type of absorption within the Jewish culture in Northern Europe of this kind of Greek philosophical speculation. Primary reason for that is because most people in the Christian European world were largely ignorant. The people who were privileged with the ability to study philosophy were only those people who were accepted into the great academies, the great Christian academies in Northern Europe. And if you weren't Christian, it was forbidden for you to engage in these scholarly pursuits. And as a general rule, the church sought to suppress widespread scholastic endeavors because the Christian world, for whatever reason, viewed it as a way of keeping everyone under their control. This is one of the very important differences between the Islamic world's worldview and the Christian world's worldview. The Christian world felt that we have to suppress literacy, we have to suppress intellectual pursuits in order to keep everyone very docile and compliant to the rules of the church. And the Islamic world took a different approach and they said, no, we want to encourage people to engage in all of the rich culture and literacy that Islam has to offer, especially in this new Cordovan caliphate, which is the brave new world. It's a world of new opportunities, new experiences, new culture, enhanced culture. It's a world of great art. It's a world of great aesthetics, of beauty, of architecture. And we want everyone in our society to be able to engage in that. So therefore, you find a much more colorful and engaged Jewish community in this land of Sfarad, in this Spanish world, than you find in Northern Europe. And Islamic Spain would end up far exceeding Christian Europe in its scholarly pursuits. One historian writes that the Caliphal Library that was contained in Cordoba had some 400,000 manuscripts contained therein, whereas the largest Christian library in Northern Europe had not more than 400 manuscripts. So it was minuscule by comparison. So in any event, you find that the Jews of this time are largely divided. You have a large number of Jews in Europe who are under Christian control, but you have the Jews that we're going to be focusing on are the ones that are located in Spain under Islamic control. And part of that aesthetic beauty that is passed down from the Cordoban Caliphate is this appreciation of poetry, it's the appreciation of music, it's the appreciation of art, and it's the appreciation of the aesthetics of language. And in particular, the Muslims who are living in southern Spain at this time emphasize the beauty of the Arabic language, and it becomes the accepted lingua franca, the national language of the world, and it becomes the language that everyone has to use, and it's the language of the sophisticates, and it's the language that you write poetry in, and there's a certain kind of poetry that Arabists use, which is extremely structured, very metered, and it becomes sort of a way of testing how scholarly you are, is if you can write clever Arabic poetry. And this was actually hotly debated within the Jewish community, because you had a number of Arabists within the Jewish community who emulated and imitated this kind of Arabic poetry, but there were many Jews who were very dedicated to the Hebrew language, and wanted to be able to compose beautiful poetry in Hebrew. So the question became, this was a great debate, hotly debated in the 10th century, should Hebraists adopt the Arabic methodology of poetry? And when we write our own national songs and songs that present our own emotional feelings and songs and things like that, should we write using the Arabic style, which is highly metered and highly structured? Or should we maintain the structure of Hebrew and use the traditional method that we find in Tanakh of the way the Hebrew language is employed, and dispensing with all of the meter and all of the highfalutin structure and the iambic pentameter and all of that other kind of stuff that's contained within the Arabic form? This was a very big controversy, and it's sometimes erupted in people getting put in prison and pointing the fingers, getting people in trouble. There was the two major people who debated this and got themselves created sort of like a very big debate. The two famous people were Menachem ibn Suruk and Dunash ibn Labrat. Now, Menachem ibn Suruk is known by many people because he's quoted by Rashi in his commentary to the Chumash. Menachem ibn Suruk was known as the great linguist by Rashi. And when Rashi had a difficult word, he would say, "I found in the Machberet of Menachem, I found in the files or the folio of Menachem ibn Suruk the explanation of what this difficult word means." So we know that Menachem ibn Suruk was a great linguist. He was also the secretary of the vizier to the caliph at the time, the ruler of the caliphate at the time, whose name was Abd al-Rahman III. He was a descendant of the original Abd al-Rahman who came in the late 8th century to come into Cordoba. And the royal vizier himself was a Jew who was very prominent in our understanding of the story of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and the Kuzari, and that's why I mention it over here at this point. And Menachem ibn Suruk felt it was very important to retain Hebrew as Hebrew and not to have it imitate a foreign language like Arabic. And Dunash ibn Labrat felt just the opposite, that if Jews are going to show their level of sophistication and we're going to show that we really truly are a cultured and literate people, then if we find something that's very sophisticated in external culture, we have to adopt it for ourselves and incorporate it into the way that we communicate. This is actually a foreshadowing of something that is going to become a dialectic within the Jewish world for many, many centuries. And that is the very important question, which I think is very important as we study the Kuzari, that when we are faced with an extremely sophisticated external culture, and we as the Jewish people are sort of deposited into that culture, how are we supposed to react to the allures of that culture? Are we supposed to say that there's something very attractive here, there's something that presents itself as potentially enhancing of Judaism and of Torah, and therefore we're going to adopt it for ourselves? Or is it more important to retain the pristine nature and the original status of Torah without it being adulterated and exposed to admixtures and distortions? And therefore we have to segregate ourselves to whatever degree that is possible and try to retain the original pristine Judaism and Torah as we know it. This is just a microcosm of that kind of debate that is already beginning in the 10th century in the area around Cordoba. Now, just to continue the history of the Cordovan Caliphate, it crumbles after about 150 years. The reason is has to do with internal strife within the Islamic world. Now, some of you are probably scratching your head and you're saying to yourselves, Muslims? Muslims are sophisticated? Muslims are philosophers? What happened to jihad? La 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 la. Right? All of that crazy stuff. Yeah? So how did this happen? In other words, how does it happen that that the Islamic world begins as being the torchbearer of Greek philosophy, tremendously cultured, tremendously literate, tremendously tolerant, tremendously dedicated to the arts and to aesthetics, and then descends into this dark pit of religious fanaticism and fundamentalism as we know it today? History plays tricks on us, and history does flip-flops. As the Christian world was mired in what was known as the Dark Ages in Northern Europe during this period of time, and really nothing greatly productive came from the general populace. You didn't have great production of aesthetics, of architecture, of great literature coming out of the Christian world in the 10th century. And yet you have the 11th century, and you have this great productive period within the Islamic world. And then you find sort of things shift so that, half a millennium later, 500 years later, the Christian world is in the period of the Enlightenment, and the Islamic world finds itself deeper and deeper mired into this dark world of religious fanaticism. It happens for a reason. Sometimes the moth gets too close to the flame and ends up getting incinerated. What eventually happened is that while the Islamic Cordoban Caliphate was extremely enlightened and literate, there were other segments of the Islamic population in other parts of the world, primarily in Africa, in Morocco, that were becoming very uncomfortable with these forms of religious expression by their more sort of enlightened brethren. And there was a lot of internal unrest, and eventually Muslims came from the south, from Africa, invaded the Cordoban Caliphate, and eventually ended up crushing it and dismantling it. So that by the end of the 11th century, the Cordoban Caliphate is no more, and in their place rises to power a group of Muslims known as the Almoravids, which is a group that came that started in Morocco. And this, it's sort of just around this time when the Cordoban Caliphate is disintegrating that Rebbe Yehuda Halevi is born. He is born towards the end of the 11th century, around 1075, 1080. He is born in a place which is smack in the middle of the country of Spain, sort of on the border of Al-Andalus, which is the Islamic portion of Spain in the Christian world. Some people place his place of birth as Toledo, which is right in the middle of Spain, as you can see on your map. Some say that he was born actually much further north, near the Navarre mountain range, sort of going all the way up towards the very, very top of Spain. But then eventually he came as a youth to Toledo. He studies in some of the great yeshiva centers, one of the great centers of Torah study in Spain, and becomes a big Talmud Chacham, studying under the Rif and the Rimigash, and is able to gain a great, tremendous level of scholarship. But there are certain experiences that he has in his life as the Cordoban enlightened golden age of Spanish Jewry is beginning to disintegrate, that clearly have certain impacts on the way that he views the world. Now, it's also important to note that Rebbe Yehuda Halevi and the Rambam, their lives intersect by 5 years. Rebbe Yehuda Halevi makes Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael and dies in the year 1140. The Rambam is born in the year 1135. So their lives intersect by 5 years, but their experiences are very, very different. Rebbe Yehuda Halevi leaves Spain just as it's descending further and further into religious fundamentalism, because not only do the Almoravids take over for the Cordoban Caliphate, but also eventually the Almoravids themselves are overrun in the middle of the 12th century by the Almohads, who are even more radical fundamentalists, and they actually actively persecute the Jewish community and create forced conversions. To the point where the Rambam, as a youth, was forced with his family to flee from Spain and resettle in Cairo, in Egypt, in order to be able to continue their lives as Jews. And yet, in Egypt, the Rambam is able to find a great amount of religious scholarship and growth, and he is able to come to an appreciation of the same Greek philosophical culture that Rebbe Yehuda Halevi has grown up in as well. However, the approaches that Rebbe Yehuda Halevi takes to his parent culture and the approach that the Rambam takes to his parent culture are almost diametrically opposed, and therefore we can sometimes say that there are two sides of this dialectic, the Halevian school and the Maimonidean school, when we talk about two different approaches as far as how to look at Greek philosophy and its role within Jewish thought. As many of you may know, the Rambam was a great appreciator of Greek philosophy. When he writes the Moreh Nevuchim, he writes the Guide for the Perplexed, it is primarily to demonstrate, very similarly, and very similar to the way that Rabbi Sadia Gaon had written his Sefer Emunot V'Deyot, his book of faith and knowledge, and using the Kalamist method, to show how the Greek philosophic method could be employed to show the certain truths of Judaism. That Judaism had its own set of dogma, had its own philosophical system that was very much oftentimes consistent with the teachings of the Greek philosophers. And that's why he wrote the Moreh Nevuchim, which was to a student who was confused and not sure whether Judaism was right for him, because he was so enthralled and bedazzled by the teachings of the Greek philosophers of his time that he didn't know whether Judaism was consistent and whether he should stay faithful as a Jew. So the Rambam writes the Moreh Nevuchim to show that Judaism contains just as much sophistication and is by and large consistent with Greek philosophy. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi takes the almost exact opposite approach, and that is to say that despite the tremendous attraction of the outside culture, despite the tremendously rich literacy and scholarship of the Greek philosophical world that our Islamic parent culture has introduced to us, it has absolutely nothing of value to offer to the Jewish mind or to the Jewish soul, and Torah is better off without it being adulterated by Greek philosophy. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi takes this to various different directions, and that's really what the whole purpose of Sefer HaKuzari is all about. But at the same time as showing how Greek philosophy has nothing to offer to the Jewish world, he also shows great deference to it and a great appreciation and knowledge of it by spending an inordinate amount of time explaining to the reader, this is what the Greeks believe, and this is what the Jews believe, and in reality, the Greeks didn't get it right. They were almost right, but they got it wrong in this area, this area, and this area. And a person really would be better off not having to study this, but since I know that you as my reader are not going to be satisfied with just saying, it's nonsense, it's all shtus, right? I have to discuss it with you and show you step by step how certain teachings of Greek philosophy are predicated on false premises and how the Torah is a far superior form of knowledge, of divine knowledge, than Greek philosophy is, despite the fact that Greek philosophy presents itself as being far more sophisticated and far more advanced in the way that it presents ideas. And it's very important for us to realize that the reason why Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wrote his Sefer, it's known as the Book of Defense, the Book of Arguments, in defense of the despised faith. Jews come into a world where Greek philosophy and art and culture are extremely extolled. And here we have the traditional Jewish community engaged in the study of Torah, engaged in the study of Talmud and Midrash and traditional Jewish texts. And one can only imagine that if you were a fly on the wall, you might have had the feeling that Jews might have had some kind of inferiority complex. That in a sense, many Jews might have been feeling that, look at the Muslims, they've gone in the short period of time that they've been around, they've far advanced beyond where we Jews have been, even though we're the oldest religion. We're still studying the ancient texts and we haven't been able to move past that, whereas the Islamic world has its Quran and has its Hadith, but at the same time, they're moving well past that. And they've been able to take all of the sophisticated knowledge of the modern world and they've been able to incorporate it into their religious thinking and into their theology. So why don't we as the Jewish people do that as well? And therefore, Judaism was viewed both for intellectual reasons as being an inferior faith, and also not only for intellectual reasons, but look at it from a historical point of view. You have an entire world which is divided by Christian domination to the north and to the west, and by Islamic domination to the south. We're the Jews. The Jews are nowhere to be found. And if they really possess the truth, and if they really are the one true faith, then how come there's such a small, silent voice within the family of man? And how come their message, if it is so persuasive and if it is so convincing, how come no one's picked up on it? How come no one's decided to become Jewish? Where is the great Jewish empire? And so one of the reasons why Rabbi Yehuda Halevi writes his book is to be able to demonstrate that power and truth does not lie in numbers. Truth is absolute, and it doesn't matter how many people believe in the truth. You could be the only person in the room who knows the truth, right? If everyone else around you is filled with falsehood and you're the only one who possesses the truth, then one of two things is possible. Either you're crazy, right? Or you actually are the one person in the world who knows the truth. And Judaism has always believed that lo miru bechem mikol ha'amim, it's not because you are the most numerous of all the nations that chashak Hashem bechem, vayibchar bechem, that Hashem has cleaved unto you and chosen you. Ki atem ha'ma'at mikol ha'amim, because you're actually the smallest of all the nations. And there's something to be said about truth being held by a silent group of people who try to keep that truth protected from the abuses of exposure to a larger world who won't appreciate it and will distort it and destroy it eventually. And so this is the world in which Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi finds himself in, and he has to also present the defense of the fact that Judaism never took a foothold in the family of man. And this is how we're going to get into our story of the Khazars. The story of the Khazars is going to be discussed next week, and I'm going to present to you why that story is so attractive to Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. But suffice it to say, the part of the reason why it's so attractive is because whereas in world history there was never an empire that was known as the Holy Jewish Empire, right? Ever since the destruction of the First Temple, there was never such a thing as the Holy. There was the Holy Christian Empire, the Holy Islamic Empire, but there was never the Holy Jewish Empire. There is one exception to that rule, that there was a period of time for about five centuries where there was a small empire where the national religion was Jewish, and that is the story of the Khazars. And if you've never heard the story of the Khazars, it's a fascinating episode in Jewish history that is unprecedented and has never taken place since. And it is something which instilled Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi with a tremendous source of pride. I didn't have time to actually go through a little bit of a biography of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's life, but I don't want to impinge on other people's time. So maybe we'll discuss that a little bit for next time, and I'll take 2 minutes for questions. And then I'll ask you just to go to the next year, if you don't mind. Yes?
My husband and I were in Spain in September. We went to Cordoba and went to the Alhambra, and we had a guide there. And I asked him, and he was telling us the same things, that how well the Jews and the Muslims got along in those days. And I said, what happened to change this? Because this equation, he said, very simple. I don't know if it's true. He said that there were two different kinds of Quran. The Quran that is now, the Quran, it wasn't the same. It was much smaller. It wasn't as amplified. The Quran itself was different. And that was sort of...
Is that right? I don't know about that. I don't know.
They changed to such an extent.
Interesting. Alhambra. Anything with an al before it is of Arabic origin. You should know that. Alhambra means, it comes from al-humr, which means the red. Because Alhambra was a city where the architecture was made out of, I believe, adobe. Yeah, so that's what the Alhambra. That's why I have Alhambra in California also. Yes?
I'm wondering about the Spanish royal family. Did they not exist at that time? Weren't they Christian? What was their effect on the culture of the period?
That's a very good question. There was a Spanish monarchy, but it only took hold in the northern part of Spain. There was chaos when Abdelrahman I came into Spain, and there was no monarchy at that time. The monarchy only rose to power later as a rival to the caliphate, and eventually it ended up the caliphate disintegrated, and eventually the Muslims by the 15th century are gone from Europe, never to be heard of until the 20th century, when they start to take over Europe once again. Okay, all right. We'll see you next week in Mitzvah Shem.